Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:50 p.m. and that is Central Time, and today is September 4th. Well, I thought I'd kick off with Asia, and I would like to also wish a happy Labor Day to everyone in the USA taking a day off. And but I thought that what's happening in China is quite rather notable. So the Hang Seng was up over 2%. It's unwinding the short-term oversold condition and coming, I think, very likely to at least go back up and test the sequence of lower rally highs. And I think what we're increasingly starting to see is some evidence that the measures that have been put in place by the administration in China to support the market are gaining traction. And the H-share index continues to bounce from the 6,000 level, and it's also coming back now to test that 200-day moving average. Now, interestingly, we've seen that Huawei has released a phone that's got chips that are reasonably comparable with what's available in an Apple today, and certainly offering the same kind of 5G speeds. And the fact that they were produced by Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corp. Now you can see very clearly at the top of the Bloomberg page, it tells you sanctions may apply to this instrument. But the share is certainly bouncing. It's also a member of the H Shares Index. So then, of course, depending on where one is located and how one is disposed, then buying the share is going to, it's quite likely to bounce further from here. But then also, betting on the index itself, whether one is buying it via an ETF or then buying it as a spread bet where you're not actually buying the index. There are, I think, ways to think about how to participate, but it certainly looks like it's moving higher from here. Now, when you delve a little deeper, what we have is an incredible competition going on within the semiconductors in the sector. For one thing, you have various generations of chips. And I remember speaking with a fairly senior executive at Intel over or just o over a couple of drinks several months ago. And one of the things we were talking about were cars. And the appeal of older modeled cars is that they are less technological. Now that's a benefit or a hindrance, depending on how one thinks about it. But if you want to own a car for a long period of time or you enjoy a particular model, then the availability of parts does become a consideration. And when you think about how chips are manufactured, well, they do have a production lifetime. And after a while, then companies no longer sustain production. So that makes it rather difficult to find parts. And it's not quite the same thing. If you're looking for a piece for a vintage car, then you might be able to find it. But if you're looking for a transistor for a piece of technology that was in a car 10 years ago, that could potentially be more difficult the further on in time we go. So when people start talking about cars that are naturally aspirated, where you don't have a turbo, then that's just the beginning of all of the gadgets that have really started to go into cars more recently. I know that mine has this connection with Bluetooth, and it has the Apple CarPlay, and all of these, and then of course it has the big touch screen as well. I don't think that's going to be a problem to replace while it's in warranty. What happens when it's 10 years old? How easy will it be to find a piece for these highly electronic cars in the future? And when we think then about how is that going to play out in terms of manufacturing? Well, on the one hand, you have historically seen that the manufacturing of chips is low margin, and the way that they have made a profit over time is that you get to charge a premium when your high-tech factory comes online, and then you continue to manufacture regardless of what the price is, and eventually you'll sell sufficient volume to recoup the multi-billion dollar cost of building it in the first place. Now, what China is looking at doing is building factories that manufacture old technology. So they're not going to get the premium at the beginning. And then they anticipate even running at a loss. And that they will flood the market with older chips. So let's start putting some numbers on it. Things that ha are chips that have 14 nanometer transistors, or even larger than that, which are good enough for the vast majority of functions in the regular economy. Now, they're not going to be cutting edge, but they'll get the job done in many cases, and most particularly in military applications. So you'll have obviously a bigger question about how does China move up the value chain. So in one respect, they're going to flood the market for mid-level, low-level chips. They may be cut out of the market for the exceptionally high value chips that are really helping to propel the outlook for companies like Taiwan Semiconductor. Or if we think then about just the broader market, like the SOX or the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, it's still right in the region of its peak. But then, of course, we have this bottleneck as well because of Moore's Law. Moore's Law basically expired in 2017, and the annual predictions for what to expect from semiconductors hasn't been printed since then. So we're in the post-Moore's Law environment. It means that it's taking longer to generate new innovations. But what it really represents is a bottleneck, that the diameter of a silicon atom is 0.2 nanometers. And we're currently at 3 nanometer technology. Well, you need more than one atom to create a transistor. So that's already approaching the physical limitations of silicon. And of course, the smaller you go, it gets exponentially more difficult to cool it down. So that means that there's going to have to be fresh innovations. And those are on the way. And you do have companies that are really investing in those kinds of new technologies. But of course, commercializing new kinds of technology is a bit of a lengthy process. Now, Intel really trended downwards in a really profound manner between 2021 and 22, but it does have first step above the base characteristics. And then IBM has also been a serial underperformer, but it is at the upper side of its range, and that range has been going on now for about 5 years. Now, both of those companies, they have historically had a lot of success developing manufacturing technology, and then have failed to follow through in terms of capitalizing on its full potential. But they're certainly in there with the potential that they have the wherewithal to develop new manufacturing technology. And then, of course, we have Google, which is investing heavily in quantum computers. Now, quantum computers are exceptionally delicate, so it's not like they're going to get shipped around. And it's unlikely that we're going to have one in our own homes until there's a really significant benefit in terms of their manufacturing prowess. But it is likely that there will be some kind of compute as a service that will be developed by companies like Google and other quantum computer companies. Now, of course, this is where the bottleneck in terms of utility, manufacturing capacity, ideas for what's new is wide open for those that are willing to invest in it. And that is, of course, where China is also heavily investing. So, because of this bottleneck around both the viability of manufacturing and profit potential from it, because it's a low margin business historically, which has been thrown out the window in many respects in the short term because of this huge surge in demand during the pandemic and then the euphoria around artificial intelligence. But historically, it is a low margin business. And then, because of the need for innovation to deliver additional new surprises, then that is creating a lump. So China will develop the older ones, and they will have a part, or they will try to develop the newer ones, and in between, they'll have difficulty sourcing the parts to develop the current ones. So that's, I think, where we're going to see a little bit of competition and conflict coming through in terms of desire to dominate the technology sector. And of course, Taiwan is in a very tight position as a result, because they dominate it. China considers Taiwan to be part of its own territory. Taiwan, in many ways, particularly the younger generations, think of themselves as independent. And there's certainly going to be a more difficult negotiation process as that continues. Because there's going to be a presidential election in Taiwan in January. And then, of course, there are other questions around China. So Vietnam continues to pop on the upside here. This is a very clear bounce from the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, the Vietnamese dong isn't exactly the strongest currency in the world. I think that's rather an exaggeration. It's still quite weak, but it was a little steadier in here today. And it is likely that the USA is going to open full diplomatic relations with Vietnam, and that's also part of a diplomatic encirclement of China as well. So that's just a clear example of how there's a lot of great power competition going on in the region. Then you have India, and the Indian market remains really quite steady. And the luxury goods companies are increasingly moving into India. They have historically benefited from the rise of the global consumer. And the global consumer and the nouveau riche generally fuel the aspirational trend in terms of spending. And that's certainly what we're starting to see with India. What India is also now beginning to become more vocal about is the fact that China is still designated as an emerging market. And at the BRICS summit in South Africa last 2 weeks ago, then Xi Jinping said that China is an emerging market and it always will be. But of course, that's logically inconsistent. If a country continues to progress, well, then it eventually will no longer be developing. It will be developed. But there are benefits to being a developing country. And the obvious one is that China has a mechanized fishing fleet, which is engaging in overfishing. But of course, if it were an emerging market, or because it is an emerging market, it gets away with that. If it were a developed market, well, then it would have to restrict some of its activities. And of course, this also applies to coal-fired power stations. And what's happening right now in Indonesia is a very interesting example that it was hailed as going to be one of the major locations for a carbon mitigation program that was going to cost around 20 billion, that half the money was going to be put up by European and North American governments. And so far, none of the money has really showed up. I think it's only around 286 million, rather than billions have turned up. And that they also massively underestimated how much coal is being used within the country because a lot of the coal-fired power stations are not connected to the grid. Instead, they are used for powering mining activities and industrial activities. And of course, what it also very clearly helps to highlight is that politicians love to make flowery pronouncements and have their photo taken. But when it comes to actually writing checks, well, then that's where realpolitik really starts to bite. Because when we think about where interest rates are and where inflationary pressures are and where the viability of public finances are in Europe and North America, then populations are in absolutely no mood to fund the modernization or decarbonization of energy policy in the emerging markets when they're seeing that their living standards and are declining and social services are badly funded. So it really means that countries have to do it on their own. And that really means that Indonesia is probably not going to be reducing its coal consumption anytime soon. And the fact is that they've got vast resources. And they're also the primary location of nickel exports with the it's incredibly dirty, it's incredibly energy intense, and it also happens to be the primary new source of nickel that has come onto the market over the last several years. The fact that Indonesia is exporting so much pig nickel is the primary reason why nickel prices collapsed and have not really recovered. But then, of course, we also have what's going on within the lithium market. And I think this is also a very interesting type of situation. It really does help to highlight just how tight the market is. We've had incredible volatility in lithium over the course of the last decade. And let's just go back and see. Well, I think perhaps the best way to do it is to put it on a logarithmic scale. So we can go back to 2011, and the price went from about 37,000 to 43,000, which was a good-sized move over the course of about 6 months. But then we had this huge move up in 2015, and prices really peaked out around 175,000. So that was an awfully big move, and then it completely collapsed, and then it surged again. So what this is really reflective of is a mismatch between production and demand. The promise of electric vehicles is out there on the horizon, and from time to time, it actually delivers. And it has succeeded in surprising the mining sector on several occasions. Now, there have been plenty of times when the mining sector has surprised and delivered that supply at exactly the time when some of that demand growth in the EV sector hasn't in fact been delivered. So we've seen both bull and bear markets. Now the price is hovering around the 200,000 renminbi per metric ton. That also happens to be around the peak from back in 2016. And then it's also in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, but below it right now. So if it's going to find support here, we're going to have to see either supply restricted, which looks unlikely, or we're going to have to see demand recovering. So that is going to be very clearly tied to what happens in China and what happens in the rest of the world in terms of electric vehicle demand. But as long as prices remain under pressure, then the aggregate of lithium miners is also likely to be under pressure as well. So there's been a mild downward bias to trading on the GlobalX lithium and battery tech ETF over the last 18 months. Now, it did pop on the upside last week, but that's just bringing it back into the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. It's got a lot of work to do between now and when it can, in fact, break that downtrend. And I think a lot is going to hinge on how well lithium prices bounce, or at least hold their lows. 200,000 renminbi is still very expensive, and it's not like lithium is a rare commodity. It's just simply a question of how it is going to be brought to market in an economic fashion. Then I think it's also interesting that you have companies like Lithium Americas, and they've basically been bending over backwards, trying to reformulate the company. And they're trying to ensure that they'll get government funding to go off and build the mine in Nevada. And the share is down from 50 to about 25. And it's also showing some initial signs of bouncing. And if it can follow through on the upside, well, that's going to look like a failed downside break and support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But it really does have to break the sequence of lower Rayleigh highs to confirm that a low of more than short-term significance has been found. So there's a lot of movement within the sector, and then we have several big companies either merging or taking over smaller companies right now. Albemarle is buying Liontown, and Allkem, which is the newer name for Orocobre, is merging with Livent. And of course, Livent was originally hived off from FMC Technologies. So there's certainly a lot of movement within the lithium sector right now. But then you have companies like Mercedes-Benz trying to get into the competition with Tesla. So they announced today that they're releasing a car with 450 miles of range that can charge 250 miles within 15 minutes. And they expect to have that car on the road in 2025. So that's given them plenty of time to figure out how to build it at scale. Now the share is coming back down, and it's right in the region of the lows from earlier this year. And if it's going to find support, well, this is about where it should start to happen. Of course, the stock is at the upper side of the range that's been underway now for the last 25 years. So there have been several occasions when Mercedes-Benz got up to test the 80 euro level and failed. And it's got a lot of work to do in order to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I saw a post today on Twitter talking about the vast quantity of steel that is required to build nuclear power plants. And it's true, they do require a lot of steel. But that is a drop in the ocean compared to the vast quantity of steel being produced globally. And of course, China has got more steel capacity than the rest of the world combined. And of course, that is also another reflection of its status as an emerging market, that it gets away with it. Then you have companies like ArcelorMittal, which have been in this lengthy base formation since 2012, and it is still steady around these levels. But it's got a lot of work to do in order to demonstrate that it's back in a demand-dominated environment. And while China is manufacturing so much steel, it would be hard to come up with a clear bullish argument. But we are seeing that there is more interest coming through in the nuclear sector. Kazatomprom has popped on the upside here, and it is now approaching the upper side of the range that's been forming for the last 2 years. This continues to look like a recovery overall, and Cameco has been leading on the upside, but now we are starting to see some of the other companies beginning to also recover. The reality is if we're going to see a clear effort to decarbonize, then there is no way to get it done without nuclear. And that is, I think, one of the clearest trends overall. If countries are really serious about decarbonization, then building more nuclear reactors, focusing on generation four reactors that make it difficult for nuclear proliferation. That's obviously something that can be enormously beneficial to the economies of emerging markets in particular. But there are quite a significant number of hurdles to get over, and not least that nuclear energy is used as a tool to rise up or to rouse nationalist fervor. We've seen some significant examples of that in China and South Korea over the course of the last month. The release of wastewater from Fukushima was allowed by the International Nuclear Agency, and it's going to take several decades, and it's going to be done in a safe manner. But there has been an incredible outpouring of emotion in social media in China. What I think is particularly relevant, it was a story that Mrs. Tracy brought to my attention this morning, is that when a CCTV personality went to the site of Fukushima and had a Geiger counter, then it was within very safe levels, and they measured it at the fish market, and it was fine too. But then lots of netizens, they saw that she had a Geiger counter, and they were saying, "Oh, we can buy those too. Let's test our own homes. Let's test the ports where we live." And the levels of radiation were many times higher than they were in Fukushima. And then they started posting about that online in the last couple of days. And then there was a statement from the Communist Party saying, no, let's things have been getting out of hand here. Japan has been our friend for a long time. It's time to stop all of this." And it is quite likely that by the time we get out to the middle of September, all record of this massive outpouring of emotion against Japan's plan to let water out of Fukushima will have been completely erased from the Chinese internet. Now, let's also just pay attention to what's going on in Europe. Europe is very dependent on what happens in terms of Chinese growth, and the Eurostoxx index has been down now for 4 consecutive days, and it has been unable to sustain a rally on either of those 4 days. So, I do think that there's a risk here that we're going to see some additional downside. Now, of course, if we get an upward dynamic, then that is going to be a clear confirmation that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But the ECB is still raising rates. They're still reducing the size of their balance sheet. And the German Bund yield is still really quite steady around the 2.5% level. So there is the potential here that we're going to continue to see yields moving on the upside in the short term. I think inevitably we're going to have a period of disinflation. But how powerful that is going to be very much tied to what exactly happens in terms of that support that China is offering. And then the real fly in the ointment, so to speak, is that oil prices remain very steady and reversed an earlier decline today to push up to another new recovery high. So there is clearly the potential here that we're going to see additional upside from the energy sector, that that China might continue to provide additional assistance. Capital being global and mobile, it will help to support asset prices internationally. That will then focus the attention of central banks on needing to continue to combat inflation, and greatly enhances the risk that they'll over-tighten. So that's certainly the potential that's underway right now. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.